Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is Friday. It is true crime time. Not so sure there was a crime committed, but we're going to find out. We're going to take a guess, going to go down that road and discuss. We're kind of like, Jen is with me as usual. Jen, how are you?
Hey, everyone. I'm good. How are you?
We are kind of like on week two of walking blind items, which I love. It's, you know, cause I do blind items. So, you know, when I find somebody who is just, you know, I imagine living in the time of Lupe Velez and getting to write blind items about her, I'm just like, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, I love the little Mexican Spitfire because, I mean, she, you know, you say there's not a crime committed, but actually I think that she committed so many crimes maybe against herself. You know, when they victimize themselves, it's that much more interested. So
you make a very valid point. Last week, you and I discussed Barbara Payton, and, you know, I said from the outset that there is nothing new to talk really about Barbara Payton because this guy, John O'Dowd, had written an exhaustive biography about her and also has he published that in 2007. And then last year he did a coffee table photo book of Barbara Payton. So, you know, obviously there wasn't a lot to talk about, and we borrowed heavily from John O'Dowd. And this week he was heard from, as I knew. Remember when we did it last week, I said, we're going to talk about it and he's going to find it. There's just no way. It, like, the guy must have some kind of special Google alert for anything that comes up with Barbara Payton. And sure enough, the other day he subscribed to the podcast and he wrote a little thing, and I don't know if anybody's seen it, so I just thought I would read it and we could finish up with the Barbara Payton thing. And he said, I'm Barbara Payton's biographer and I appreciate you discussing her almost unbearably sad life on your podcast. Thank you too for mentioning my work on Barbara's story. I began researching her life in earnest in 1998 for her biography, Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye, The Barbara Payton Story, which was published in 2007. And last year, my coffee table photo book, Barbara Payton, A Life in Pictures, was published and is thankfully being received well by her fans. The book contains more than 1,000 photos and hundreds of captions and quotes about Barbara, and it's available at Amazon. And he wanted to let us know that there are some good qualities to offset what we focused on about her in the podcast. And, you know, and Jen and I have discussed this, you know, we have a certain limited amount of time, and the gossip is the good stuff. You know, with all the things that she did, there's a limited amount of time, but he wants everybody to know that she was generous to a fault and that she gave away many thousands of dollars to friends and family during her lifetime. That she was a gourmet cook who loved to host lavish parties. But isn't that, didn't we decide that that was also what was causing her to lose all her money, was all these parties?
Exactly. That's how she went broke. So to be fair, you know, that stuff just was not beneficial to her, and she was a good mother, and her son did end up forgiving her, and he loves his mother, and he, you know, forgives her pitfalls and things like that. But, you know, our audience doesn't want to hear 100,000, you know, good things about Barbara Payton. Everybody has really great qualities, but, you know, we're not knee padding over here. We're going to talk about, you know, the gossip. We're a gossip house. That's what we're going to look at.
But if you are interested in getting either of those books, I think he would appreciate it. You can go to johnodowd.com. And take a look, you know, and see if you want to purchase either of those. And I think that, you know, I owe that to him, especially since he did most of the research and also subscribed to the podcast.
His books are fantastic. I did look at it. So, you know, if you love Barbara Payton, you love old Hollywood, you know, definitely check those out.
With Lupe, I've actually had a couple of blind items about her over the years. One was in December 2014. Honestly, I don't know if these have been revealed or not. I didn't look to see if I'd revealed them, so they could be exclusive reveals. The one from December 2014 is, what foreign-born A/B-list actress known for her off-screen liaisons, volcanic temper, and her mysterious death appeared in several SAG films before she was famous, some of them being Girl on Girl? That does not surprise me one little bit after the research that we have done on Lupe. I could see that for sure. The other one is from January 2016. And when you read it as a blind, it is very difficult to follow in a podcast. So I'm just going to read it as it would have been, you know, revealed essentially. And it is Cooper talking about Gary Cooper, was still carrying on with Lupe Velez. He wanted to marry her, but Cooper's mom, who was right there in L.A., thought her too vulgar and tasteless. We might attribute her verdict to good old-fashioned racism, but Lupe was a bit of a hot mess, or at least that's how the press chose to portray her, most likely in keeping with her on-screen image as a fiery Latina. She loved acting low class and threw parties with cockfights and stag films, aka thinly veiled porn. I don't know if she aired her own or not. She got in fights, especially over men, and was prone to extreme jealousy. To wit, angry over Cooper's close friendship with Anderson Lawler, known in the Times parlance as a swisher or flamboyant homosexual, Velez supposedly unzipped Cooper's fly at a social gathering and started sniffing his crotch, claiming to smell Lawler's cologne. You can see how this would be difficult to say all the different categories of people and everything. Velez was also framed as an animal of desire. Cooper gave her two eagles, lovebirds, to symbolize their predatory affection. Predatory. And their shared bed was 8 feet square. And that's, you know, something that you and I will talk about later. When they came to get her on that bed, they thought she was like 2 feet tall because this bed was so big. It just threw everything out of scale. Which, as film scholar Henry Jenkins points out, makes it sound more like a wrestling ring than a boudoir. How much of these reports were true and how much were fabricated to fit her image as a Mexican Spitfire may never be known. What's to be relished, however, is how she and Dietrich went head-to-head on the set of Morocco. Velez insisted on being on set at all times with good cause, given Cooper's tendencies and Dietrich's je ne sais quoi. She became even more aggressive as filming continued, and evidence of an affair seemed to materialize. Nobody knows what that evidence was. Was it more crotch sniffing or something? The fan magazine satirized their competition, and Velez, famous for her impersonations, did a devastating satire of Dietrich at a prominent Hollywood gathering. In hindsight, Dietrich would explain that Gary was totally under the control of Lupe. This is just... and I talk about women dividing themselves for the fight for men, but Cooper was not immune or ignorant to the games being played in his name. He lost 40 pounds over the course of he and Velez's 3-year relationship, and Velez shot at him when he left Los Angeles by train to Chicago. She missed, started swearing at a poor aim, and fled arrest. There you go. That's kind of the gist of the blind item. And a crazy blind item it is, until you realize it's pretty accurate about Lupe Velez.
Yeah, there was actually witnesses that saw like 6'3" Gary Cooper running from little 5'4" Velez. So just picturing that alone is funny.
So I said that stuff. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Lupe?
Lupe might have been crazy because she was a little spitfire even when she was little. You know, she was growing up. She was born and raised in Mexico before she came to Hollywood, and she became one of the, you know, one of the biggest Spanish crossovers. But she started fighting, you know, as like a very young girl. And she was actually someone that was, too much for girls. She had to play with little boys because she was just too rough. So her life just kind of jump starts from there, and it really shapes who she becomes as an adult.
Yeah. And we need to make clear that Lupe did not come from a poor family. She came from a very wealthy family. Very prominent family. And, you know, much is made later on about, oh, you know, she couldn't speak English very well. She could speak it perfectly. They just chose to, kind of portray her, you know, that way. And when she grew up, she was born in 1908, but when she grew up, there was a revolution going on in Mexico, and her dad joined the fight and, crazy, took her with him sometimes. And she talked about riding horseback with him in the Mexican army and watching his people and people tried to kill him. I'm not sure that this is something that a young girl probably needs to see. And maybe that affected her, you know, when we talk about her kind of, you know, being hard on herself or committing crimes on herself. Because she says, I do not cry. I do not have goose pimples on my flesh. I do not have fears of the bullets. But she was traumatized. Wouldn't you agree? Probably.
Absolutely. Yeah. Everything that she saw in that Mexican Revolution desensitized her. So when it came to her and Gary Cooper get into these violent fights, her drawing knives on people, you know, her shooting at people, she thought nothing of it because as a young child, she had seen violence her whole life.
Yeah. I mean, even, okay, there's a lot of kids, you know, perform at home or on the street or whatever. She would act out shows where her leading male co-stars were pillows that she would hug and kiss. And then she would say, sometimes they're bad men. And so then she grabbed a big knife and would stab the pillows repeatedly. That doesn't seem like normal, everyday kind of behavior.
Yeah, not so much. And the fact that she was so aggressive towards not just men, but also women. You know, it's like, where did she see that? I understand in the war when you're seeing your man, your father go out on quit a mission, as she called him. You know, he's killing other men, shooting their horses out from under him. But where did she get the hatred of women? You know, I'm always really curious about that.
You know, I don't, because she always wanted to be first, right? I mean, and her family, because, you know, she was acting out like this, they sent her to a convent school in San Antonio, but she was horrible there. But she was called back home, not because she got kicked out of the convent school, but because her father went missing in action and was presumed dead in the war. And then all of a sudden, her wealthy, prestigious, prominent background, there's no more money. It just, it left the family, you know, indigent. And so she went back to Mexico and took a job as a salesperson in a department store to support the family.
Yeah, she had to. No one else in her family wanted to work. They were so privileged, and they had been privileged for so long that none of them had a work ethic, just her.
Yeah, and I mean, it's great that she did, and it just shows you how prominent the family was, that they looked down on anybody that was working. But she's like, we have to have money. And as she got older, she said to her mom, hey, you know, I'm interested in vaudeville shows, you know, Mexican vaudeville shows. That was the big thing then. And her mom pulled some connections and got her an audition. Her father had never wanted her to be an actress. And because they didn't know if dad was really dead or not, because he'd just been missing, she performed under her mother's maiden name to avoid her father ever finding out. And this is where I think what you're saying, where this, you know, dislike of other women, because she was told that her part would be as a supporting cast member. And she said, I'll be a star and sing and dance alone. And I feel like that kind of sums up, you know, Lupe when it comes to, you know, just about everything that she did. You know, she's going to be the star. You're going to notice her if she has to shoot Gary
Cooper at it. I absolutely admire her confidence. I mean, she definitely had that.
And during the first performance, her ukulele strings broke. And I mean, I don't know where this thought came from for her, but she didn't panic. And then she just started shaking her breast wildly. And then the crowd went crazy. And because of that, she went on to perform in Mexico to sold out crowds.
Yeah, I want to know where she first learned that. I wonder if she saw her mother, you know, perform like that, maybe. But she said, you know, do they love me? They go crazy. And she would just, you know, she'd shake her lady butts. It is funny to watch, because she went on to be a triple threat. She could sing, she could dance, and of course she could act. So, I mean, she was the total package.
I'm wondering, and this is just, there's no evidence, just wondering aloud, because her dad was gone a lot, right, to go fight. Perhaps, well, no. If her mom had an affair, and then she might, you know, hate her mom or whatever, and other women. But, her, you know, she did go to her mom to get help for vaudeville, so I'm not sure where it came from.
Yeah, you have, like, the biggest female, I think, in her life, you know, helping her get a role. So you'd think, well, that's a positive aspect of feminism. You know, why does she hate women so bad? But then you read that she entered a talent contest, and, ooh, much to her dismay, she comes in second place. That's not okay with Lupe. So she attempts to commit suicide, and I wonder if she didn't lose first place to a female.
I mean, I'm guessing probably, and maybe she could have handled losing to a man. I doubt it. I mean, Lupe didn't like to come in second anything, but it shows from an early age that she was, you know, because she didn't actually get out to Hollywood until 26. So she would have been 18 years old. So the talent contest, she would have been probably 16 or 17 years old. I mean, that's pretty young to say, you know, I can't come in second. I'm gonna have to kill myself.
Yeah, it seems like that throughout her life, she struggled with the whole suicide thing quite a bit, sadly.
I wonder if it's because, you know, her dad, a colonel in the Mexican military, you know, one step short of a general, probably headed that way. He probably said, you need to be perfect. There's no other way to be. Maybe something like that.
Yeah, that, and also she saw so much death as a child that she grew up, like I said, desensitized. And to her, death was not scary. So her attempting to take her life to her was just second nature. It was not anything that was freaky. You know, it might have freaked out her mom, but, you know, Lupe, not so much.
That's a good thought. I didn't even think about that because she had seen so much death that being desensitized, I mean, she said, well, whatever. It's, you know, I can handle, you know, killing myself or whatever. And, you know, I think you could I think you're right on that. Because we tend to think of desensitization as just kind of looking at, you know, all these people being killed, but it gives you a different perspective on death, on everything, right?
Absolutely.
But the, one of the, in 1926, along came Richard Bennett. He was the father of movie stars Joan and Constance, and he asked Lupe to come to Hollywood to be in American movies. And I guess it took a while for her to get there, because by the time she reached Hollywood, Bennett had already replaced her with someone else. And so not wanting to be second place again, she kept auditioning. So this is, I mean, this to me also is Lupe. She gets a big break in Hollywood. She's going to be, you know, probably some kind of role in that thing, but she doesn't want to be a supporting role. She wants to be the star. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. She always wants to be the star. And another thing about her is that she's always on Lupe time. So if he had invited her, say, you need to be here in February, she might have showed up somewhere about mid-April.
Yeah.
That's just who she was.
But she kept auditioning and she landed a part in MGM Sailor's Beware. And it was just a part. It wasn't the lead. So I think at some point she realized, okay, maybe I can't just start off as a star. Maybe it took that little bit of, you know, being there and having somebody explain it to her. But from there, she caught the eye of Douglas Fairbanks, who gave her her big break when he cast her in the movie The Gaucho. And during her audition, he asked her to take off her shoes since her character would be barefoot. And she said, no. And then Douglas Fairbanks said, well, then you don't get the part. And she goes, I don't take off my shoes for you or no one. I go back to Mexico. And not only did she win the part, but then she and Douglas Fairbanks started hooking up.
Well, of course. And I'm sure he never saw that coming, because this was the day and age of when the casting couch was ablaze. I mean, all the legs were open. Everyone wanted into Hollywood. Everyone wanted a part. And the way they got it was to do the casting couch. So to see her come along and say, no, thanks, I don't need you, I'll go back to Mexico. He's like, wow. you know, she really is a spitfire, and I need some of that.
Now, we talked about Barbara Payton in the 50s or so, making, I think it was $10,000 a week. Lupe, late 20s, she is the first Mexican actress to really make it big in Hollywood, and she gets about $2,000 a week. I mean, $2,000 a week is a lot of money now. $2,000 a week in 1927, I mean, that's pretty good. And
that is fantastic. And I'm telling you, she was worth it. I started watching some of her movies on YouTube, and before I knew it, I was watching like 5 and 6, 7, you know, I just couldn't get enough of her. She is so funny.
Now, she might not have been the complete first. There's kind of an argument, because some people say that Dolores Del Rio was first, and they had a long, long rivalry that was kind of egged on, manufactured, created by the press. And, you know, and I think that that kind of played a big part. She didn't like to be in competition. She wanted to be considered the best. And one of the things that made her the best, and a lot of people don't realize this, silent film stars didn't always make it into the talkies. Because you could be, you know, gorgeous and attractive and had, you know, some kind of, you know, horrible German accent or something like that. Or, you know, you couldn't talk very well. And you couldn't make that transition, but she had no problem whatsoever making that transition.
No, she did it flawlessly. When you say like je ne sais quoi, she had it. I mean, this woman could come straight off silent film right into a speaking role, and she never missed a beat. And I think that's just the leg up that she had on Dolores Del Rio. You know, I think that Lupe was just phenomenal.
And here's the thing is that studio bosses loved her, because they joked that when she puckered up her lips, it was impossible, and this is a great actress, it was impossible to tell if she was going to kiss you, bite you, or spit on you. And they loved that, that the fact that she could, you know, use her acting, and just, you didn't know what direction she was going to go in. But they kind of, you know, generally made her the sex symbol, kind of the sex pot kind of thing. And she became extremely popular in the gossip columns because of her personal life. And it's the reporters that refer to her as the Mexican Spitfire, Whoopi Lupe, and Mexican Hurricane. But they weren't wrong to call her those things. I mean,
no, not at all. And she loved the gossip. She would submit pieces on herself. So, you know, she wasn't one who wouldn't laugh at herself. I mean, she absolutely would. And, you know, when you have like cookie cutter Hollywood, you know, you have all the American actresses that, you know, for the most part, they're brunette or they're blonde. They kind of all sound the same. They look the same. She was different. So when she came in, you know, she was like a breath of fresh air.
And at Hollywood parties, she would pull her dress over her head and flash everyone. And she wasn't wearing any underwear, at all, because she loved the attention. And I mean, that was not really behavior, I think, that you really saw in the 1920s.
No, not normally.
No. And as you said, I mean, the violence towards other women was there pretty much straight on. I mean, she got into a fight, a fist fight, not just, you know, yelling at somebody, with Lillian Tashman in the bathroom of this cafe. And, you know, at this kind of all white attire kind of fancy thing hosted by Carol Lombard, she threatened to slit Norma Shearer's throat with the knife she always kept in her garter. You know, I mean, and so what did Norma do? She wore a red dress. I mean, that was kind of it. But, and who carries a knife in your garter all the time, you know?
Lupe, the daughter of a Mexican colonel. That's who. Yeah, they say that, you know, it's not a normal fist fight when you get into something with Lupe, because she would wear diamonds on just about every finger, and she made sure that they were the big whopping diamonds. So when mm-hmm. she hit you, you know, it would definitely draw blood.
The feud of feuds was against Libby Holman, and it was during this musical, like a stage. It was on stage, and it was called You Never Know. And in between curtain calls, so they made it professionally through the production, you know, through the actual show. But in between curtain calls, they're like, you know, hurling insults at each other. And then Lupe punched Libby in the face, and people could hear Lupe yelling from behind the curtain, "Libby, you son of a bitch, you bastard, I kill you with this." And then it was that diamond ring, right? I mean, it just... That it's kind of thing like brass knuckles, but she's got diamonds to do it, right?
And oh, absolutely. Yeah, legal brass knuckles. And she had this thing where she would do these impersonations, and not everyone thought that they were respectable. She would mimic like Gloria Swanson, Shirley Temple, sometimes Greta Garbo, and she could act it out very well, but, you know, she's mocking someone. So this Holman woman, she didn't like it at all. And that's when they got into fistfights over. And if you look at her 1937 film High Flyers, she does all the impersonations at once. It's incredible. So, like, look that up. But that is what set that woman off.
Yeah. And, you know, and this actor Clifton Webb, he said, you know, you need to stop it before people in Hollywood turned against her. But this is Lupe. She goes, I don't care. You know, it's like, I can go back to Mexico. You know, I'm fine. You know, I did it there before. The crowds in Mexico love me. I don't really need Hollywood, you know, and... That's a completely different thing than most actresses at the time who just always wanted to stay, you know, A-list, and they couldn't deal with the thought of not being, you know, wanted or, you know, dumped by a studio. Lupe didn't care because
she didn't care. She couldn't be compromised no matter what. You know, she's like, I don't need you. I'll leave. And in fact, you know, when filming was over, if she was filming a movie or something, she's like, okay, I'm out of here. I'm going to the boxing ring.
Yes. And she went every single Friday, just about, to these boxing matches in Los Angeles. And she would come in wearing her furs, dripping in diamonds, and she loved the attention. Because, I mean, there's not very many Lupes. And she used to sit in the front row, and she would yell at the boxers. She once attacked a referee with an umbrella because she didn't like a call he made. I mean, she was the ringside show. This is kind of, you know, if you think about like pro wrestling or something, you know, if she could, she would have been perfect as a manager. In a pro wrestling event, you know, always, you know, playing tricks and things like that. I think she would have been perfect.
Oh, she was so like the Vicky Guerrero of her time, no doubt. I mean, 5'4", yelling at these big men from the side of the ring. She became her own sideshow, and they would actually shine a spotlight on her seat, and they would wait for her to get there and then shine it kind of like mid-show, you know, to see like her antics and stuff, and the audience just ate it up.
Yeah. I mean, and that's her kind of thing. And that's why I said, you know, where she doesn't care, because she would still have that life and she would still, you know, have that attention. And if you go back to her first vaudeville show, it was all about getting the attention and having the eyes on her. And she knew that she could get that, and she didn't need to be in the movies to get it. She could just get it in real life.
Yeah, absolutely. And the show followed her. And when she walked into the room in 1929 to film Wolf Song, she caught the attention of Gary Cooper, who at the time was gorgeous. And he was, you know, the leading man of the time. And, you know, if you can get Gary Cooper's attention, you're pretty good.
Yeah. And so 1929, and then in between 1929 and 1931, things are odd. In 1931, he finally breaks things off with her. And this is when she followed him to the train station. And, you know, he was waiting to board the train. And then she says, "Gary, you son of a bitch." And just kind of like the gun goes out. And apparently Gary Cooper managed to duck inside. And, you know, he was not just leaving the city or the state. I mean, he was leaving the country. And, you know, he went to Europe. And it was essentially because he was losing this weight and just kind of getting everything drained by Lupe that the studio, this is their big star, they said, you've just got to break it off with her. I mean, you got to leave. And it's interesting. I had talked to Jen a little bit about this before, but I noticed the address where Lupe died, and I looked it up, and I remembered thinking, well, Gary Cooper must have lived right around there. And sure enough, they live next door to each other. And I don't know if Gary was still living there when she died, but it seems really odd that if you're trying to get away from somebody, that you would live next door to them.
Yeah, that's a bit suspicious. You know, I wish I could go back in time and interview a lot of these people, because I definitely have questions, especially with how her life ended and just the rumors that were swirling. But if, you know, he's trying to flee to Europe to flee her, I wonder if, you know, like hindsight's everything, if he was publicly fleeing her, but privately, you know, he still kind of had like a little burning flame for her.
But, you know, he was right to get away, because if it was the situations were reversed, we would have told her to get out of there right away. Because this was not the first time that Lupe had engaged in violence during this 3 years. She had stabbed him with a kitchen knife, which resulted in a large gash and him needing stitches. And when he was leaving, she attempted to break a train window in order to embrace him before he pulled away. Lupe told a fan magazine, "I think I will kill my Gary because he does not get angry when Lupe is angry with him."
Yeah, and Gary Cooper's mother, she read that and panicked. And then after that, for at least a year, Lupe and Gary Cooper's mom go on to exchange jabs in the gossip column. So his mom was like very much in his life, and she came out swinging against this woman. She's like, "I don't trust her. You've got to get away."
Yeah. I mean, and then, you know, the thing I talked about in The Blind Item about Marlene Dietrich, it was a movie with Marlene Dietrich and Katharine Hepburn. And Lupe would get to the set early. She would sit in Gary Cooper's lap, make sure that Marlene couldn't seduce him, although, you know, maybe she ended up doing it. But also Lupe didn't worry too much about Katharine Hepburn because she wasn't sure that Katharine really was interested in men. So she just let Katharine, you know, do her thing. And maybe it's the same thing that keeps, you know, people with their abusers. But I mean, Cooper managed to stay, according to him, crazy in love with Lupe. You know?
I think he was crazy in love with the sex, because she was a spitfire, you know, by all accounts. And, you know, the whole, she had a huge bed, you know, no matter where she lived, a huge bed. And I tend to think that like their antics in bed kept him coming back for more, you know, even though she sometimes stabbed him with kitchen knives.
Yeah. I mean, and he said she flashes, stormed and sparked. And on the set, she was apt to throw things if she thought it would do any good. But she objected being called wild. She'd say, "I'm not wild. I'm just Lupe." you know, and she said to a reporter, "My life story, it's the story of a devil. And who wants to print the story of a devil? I am wild. I cannot help it." And I mean, so Cooper, you know, he's lost all this weight. You know, it's somewhere between 35 and 45. And nobody knows exactly, but a ton. And he had bouts of trembling due to stress. His hair was falling out. I mean, it was time for him to go, at least for a little while.
Yeah, I think Paramount had big, you know, step in him moving towards that direction. You know, they maybe threatened his contracts or something like that. They're like, "Hey, look, you got to do something." So, you know, he did. He broke it off.
And it was not long before Lupe found somebody else. And she found another huge actor at the time, Johnny Weissmuller. And he was the Tarzan. He wasn't the original, but I mean, famous for the Tarzan movies. And, you know, he was this former Olympic swimming champion, and Lupe referred to him as a piece of sculpture. But the two fought and made up constantly. They decided, hey, let's get married. And they fought so much that they would be at a movie premiere and just start fighting with each other. They would be at nightclubs and start fighting with each other, and everybody loved to see their fights.
Absolutely, because she would sneak off from him and go into the corner of these nightclubs, you know, especially Ciro's nightclub, and she would again pull her dress up over her head, expose her private parts, and then he would get mad. He'd go to the kitchen and get whatever tray of food that he could find, and he would throw it at her private parts to try to get her to stop.
Yeah, and he wanted her to know he didn't approve of her behavior, so she filed for divorce a couple of times, but withdrew them, and then they would reconcile. And she described, you know, a typical evening. And she goes, for no reason, I punch him right on the nose. He rears up and says, Mama, you hit me. And I say, darling, I'm so sorry. Hit me back. I mean, this is not a one-time thing.
She liked to fight.
She did.
She was a fighter for sure. And they would beat each other up so bad that the MGM hair and makeup department, they had a time like trying to cover up all the marks that she left on him, you know, because he's shirtless. He's Tarzan.
Yeah. So, I mean, and, you know, good for him that, you know, he didn't hit her back or anything like that, because I'm sure he could have killed her. But one day he returned home to discover that his dog was dead. And he blamed Lupe for poisoning the dog because she was jealous of the affection he showed it. And then so he got mad about the dog. So he broke her parrot's neck. I mean.
Oh, these two. Oh, Lupe.
I know. So finally they get divorced in 1938. And she called Weissmuller as a furniture-breaking caveman. But, you know, Lupe was never alone for long. She had affairs with Charlie Chaplin and Tom Mix and Clark Gable and John Gilbert and Errol Flynn and Jack Johnson the boxer and Jack Dempsey the boxer, who was married to her friend. The guy that she broke up with, Big Boy, right? Quinn Big Boy Williams. And she broke up with him at Errol Flynn's home, which is awkward enough if you've already been sleeping with Errol Flynn, right? And so you're at a party at his house, and she took a frame picture of Big Boy Williams off the wall and then threw it at him, and she hit him. And so that was a nice little breakup right there.
Absolutely. That girl got around.
I know. And Mexico wanted her. They wanted her to come home and be a big star in her country. And so in 1938, she went back to Mexico to star in her first Mexican film. And people were surprised. She was still wearing a bent nail around her finger that had been fashioned into a ring by her father. And she was one star. Think about this now. She was a star who allowed her personal phone number to be listed in the phone book. I mean, that's...
Yeah, she would field calls, just cold calls from the public, and especially if it was people that were depressed, you know, down on their luck and things like that, which is kind of, like, poignant now when you look back at what happened to her. But, I mean, now that would be just such a safety risk, I would think.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, hey, do you give Lupe a call? She'll talk to you. I mean, and she would... this is kind of about the same time that she started fighting with Dolores Del Rio a lot. And... You know, I think part of it is she was probably jealous, you know, that there was somebody competing for her parts. But I think a lot of it, she would probably, you know, because she would read the gossip pages and everything like that and read what they said. And the reporters called Del Rio the higher class and Velez the lower class. You know, but we know that's not to be really true. I mean, if you think about, you know, the family that she came from and everything.
This girl was intelligent. You know, when movie studios put you into contracts, okay, sometimes they refer to them as slave contracts, you have to be the character. You know, you look at Britney Spears, she has to be the character. The voice can't change, the persona can't change. And if you go outside of that, you know, you get ridiculed and the studio will clamp down on you. I think with her, she wanted to show people how smart she was. And they were like, no, because that's out of character. You know, we need you to be crazy. We need you to be a little, you know, a little broken English, a little off. And, you know, the gossip tabloids try to use that against her, which is sad.
It is. And everybody, well, her biographer is pretty sure that Lupe's scripts were purposely written in broken English. And, you know, and Lupe would joke about it. And because she couldn't go against the studio, right, or her contract. And she said, everybody says, why don't you learn better English, Lupe dear? So I answer, I was married to a guy who could only say me, Tarzan, you, Jane. How can I learn English from him? You know?
And I love that she turned that around and she would not allow them to weaponize that against her. Perfect comeback.
Yeah. And, I mean, Lupe was a big star. I mean, in 1939, she starred in this comedy, The Girl from Mexico. And then it spawned seven television sequels known as the Mexican Spitfire series. And, I mean, it was way ahead of its time. Think about in 1939. It's a mixed-race couple. You know, on television, this is the advent of television, the first couple years of broadcasting, and they have this. It was also the first time a television series featured a non-white actress in a starring role. There is talk that it inspired, you know, Modern Family with Sofia Vergara. But the success is not something that, as much as Lupe wanted attention, the success part, I think, really kind of hurt her a little bit.
Yeah, I think so, too. It started making her depressed, and it was taking a toll on her. And if you want to laugh just so hard, you know, because, you know, things in the world are not great right now. So if you want to have a little laugh, go look up The Mexican Spitfire Sees a Ghost that was filmed in 1942. That is her funniest episode off that whole Spitfire series. She's pretending to be a cat, but she's a Mexican cat. So she's like really rare. So just go look that up and you'll laugh for sure. But it says that she became really burned out after filming this.
Yeah, you know, because TV is a different kind of thing than a movie, right?
Definitely.
And so then she had an affair with this actor, Arturo de Cordova, in 1943. But Lupe said, hey, we're engaged. But Arturo's wife begged to differ. you know, Lupe broke things off with him. He had told her that he was single. And kind of, in a way, because things were different. You know, he had asked his wife for a divorce, but she refused to grant it. And, you know, that was kind of, it was a lot tougher sometimes to get a divorce. There's no such thing as irreconcilable differences and everything. And so, you know, he may have tried to go on with life without his wife, but legally he couldn't get very far. And Lupe, of course, wasn't going to wait around at all. So the next year, this is the one that kind of ruined her. She started dating an Austrian gigolo, Harold Raymond. And a couple of months into dating, she realized that she was pregnant. And this is where things begin to get murky. Would you agree to that?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, Gary Cooper supposedly gets word of this and he starts screaming that, you know, I'm going to kill you because you got her pregnant. But, you know, we'll talk about why that's shady later. But she's Catholic. She cannot have a baby out of wedlock. In her head, this is the worst possible scenario that could ever happen to her. So she starts looking at her options. You know, can I move back to Mexico and have the baby? Can I give it to one of my sisters? You know, all this stuff's going through her head. And then she thinks, oh, I know. I'll get him to marry me.
Yeah. And she begged him, you know, Harold to marry her, but he refused. And she told people that she dropped to her knees at night and prayed for him to marry her. But those prayers went unanswered. And she didn't understand why God wouldn't help her. And those around her believed there was more to Harold turning her down, but she insisted that, you know, his betrayal of her heart was the last straw. And, you know, on the evening of December 13th, 1944, she had dinner around 9 o'clock, which is very late, with actresses Estelle Taylor and Benita Oki, and which is kind of interesting because we've talked about all this hate that she has for other women, but her last dinner is with two actresses.
Yeah. She's,
you know,
getting Fielding, which I also thought was interesting. You make a very, very good point as to why she chose them.
Yeah. You know, and she comes home to her house, which, by the way, is valued today at $10 million. And she washed down over 70 Secanol pills with a glass of brandy. And then the next day, her secretary, Beulah Kinder, found the 4-month pregnant actress draped across. At first, she thought that Lupe was just sleeping because she looked so peaceful. But after seeing the suicide note near her bed, she understood what happened. And the suicide note was addressed to Harold. And this is kind of where I get you know, the theories that we're going to talk about in a minute, this kind of leads me just to Harold. You know, I know we're going to talk about other things, but it said to Harold, may God forgive you and forgive me too, but I prefer to take my life away and our babies before I bring him shame or killing him. And then at the back of the note said, how could you, Harold, fake such great love for me and our baby when all this time you didn't want us? I see no other way out for me, so goodbye and good luck to you. Love, Lupe. Perfect English, by the way.
Yeah, perfect English, and she reveals they were going to have a boy.
Yeah, and you know, it just, here's the thing, is that she is supposedly this super devout Catholic, which I have no doubts of. Yeah. But if you kill yourself in the Catholic Church, you're in purgatory forever. And she didn't want to get an abortion because that's very, you know, anti-Catholic. But she ends up killing the baby by doing this. You know? I just...
Yeah, I don't really understand the reasoning behind that. But if you're so grief-stricken and you feel like your back's against the wall, are you thinking in a correct frame of mind? Probably not. And I wonder if she started writing this after she had taken maybe the first couple second all pills, you know, and she's just really foggy before downing the rest of the ones that would, you know, go on to make her meet her demise. But I do see what you're saying as far as logic.
You know, I just, and like you said, I mean, maybe logic was out the window. Maybe she thought the only way to accomplish this was to get married. And if that wasn't going to happen, then, you know, her life would be ruined in the eyes of God. But like I said, if the other two options, they're going to be ruined too. So I don't really get. And then there was another letter on the scene. And by the way, if you want to see the suicide note, it's available on Google. You can Google it and see it. But another letter at the scene was addressed to her secretary, and she asked her to take good care of her dogs, Chips and Chops. Mm-hmm. And she left Kinder the majority of her estate. She left only a small portion to her own mother. Which again, you know, maybe as she matured, you know, the relationships with women got better. Cause you know, a lot of the fights we're talking about happened early on, you know, 10, 12 years earlier.
Yeah, and because she preferred women who wouldn't challenge her. So when she really loved her secretary Kinder, that woman was no threat to her. She wasn't trying to be an actress in the spotlight or anything. She was a, you know, yes, ma'am, I'm coming, ma'am, just very, very kind-hearted.
And then a policeman who was called noted that Lupe looked so small in that oversized bed. He thought she was a doll, actually, because that bed was so big. And the next night, you know, they put the spotlight on Velez's empty ringside seat at the boxing match. And, you know, they signaled the fight was over. And she had a Hollywood funeral, but was buried in Mexico with her family. At that last dinner, I mean, Estelle was there and she talked about it. And she said that Lupe was distraught over the pregnancy, you know? And this is kind of that back and forth, where she actually, you know, is relying on, like you said, you know, female point of view on what to do.
Well, and we all know that she didn't handle rejection well. So to me, more so than the baby, I think it was the rejection. You know, she didn't see this guy telling her, no, I don't want you, and no, I won't marry you. You know, to her, that was just the absolute last straw. And, you know, she's fielding opinions on what she should do. But really, I mean, do we think she had already made her mind up?
I think so, because she went home and, you know, did it right away.
Yeah.
And, you know, Estelle said that Lupe would rather die than kill her baby, but she ends up killing the baby anyway. There's this guy, Robert Slatzer. He claims to have spoke to both Lupe and Gary Cooper shortly before the body was found. And he claims the three were discussing how Cooper could be the father of the baby and not Harold. But either way, she rejected both men. And, you know, Gary Cooper was married by that time to a socialite. And, you know, Robert Slatzer, I mean, this is the guy who claimed that he was secretly married to Marilyn Monroe. So let's take what he says with a grain of salt.
Yeah, absolutely. We don't know how much we can trust from that guy. But if that is true, a huge if, then that puts her and Gary Cooper still talking on the phone long after he said he wanted nothing else to do with her. And that would be kind of interesting.
They live in next door. I got to check to see when he moved out of that house, because I mean, if they are still next door to each other, even if Gary's married, I mean, Gary could have been the father.
Exactly. Imagine, like, you know, slipping through the fence slats and be like, you know, hey, let's have a little romp. And, you know, that kind of changes her whole story if we find out that he was still living next to her.
Yeah. I mean, Claire Beau claimed that Gary Cooper called her screaming that he was going to kill Harold for getting Lupe pregnant. Clara didn't believe the baby was Harold's, even though Gary Cooper had called Clara to say that Harold got her pregnant. She believes that Harold was being suckered into protecting Gary Cooper's reputation, and that's why he was hesitant and why he broke up with Lupe. But then this would say that Lupe was cheating on Harold, you know?
Yeah, and if he caught her, then that may give very good reason why he would not marry her and why he didn't want to talk to her further, because if it was Cooper's baby, you know, Harold doesn't need to deal with any of this drama.
I guarantee you. I guarantee 1,000% that if Lupe and Gary were still living next door to each other, they were hooking up.
I am on board with that for sure.
And then after the death, Harold told the press that he was so confused by the suicide and that even though the two had broken up, he had agreed to marry her. But he wanted Lupe to sign an agreement admitting that he was only marrying her to give the baby a name.
And isn't that telling? See there? I'm just going to give it a name. That kind of makes us still think that if you read into that, he doesn't think it's his either.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if he's telling the truth, I mean, that's not, you know, a horrible thing. I mean, he's giving her an out, and she's already been married before and got divorced, and that's very anti-Catholic. So, you know, I think she picks and chooses on her Catholicism. Because back then, getting divorced as a Catholic was horrific, right? I mean, that was a sin.
It was, but I think something deeper was going on with these two under the surface. She goes on to tell her secretary, the one she loves so much, Kinder, that you know Raymond was faking a relationship with her and that he didn't want the baby or the baby wasn't his. But I mean, the whole fake thing, you know, I'm like, why would she care? He offered to marry her and give the baby a name, you know, regardless if there was love in the marriage or not. And she balked on that. But, I mean, what exactly did she think that he was being fraudulent about?
I don't know. I mean, and Johnny Weissmuller, he believed the mystery death was caused by an attempt to put a lid on what had really transpired. He said that Kinder found the body and called Beau Roos, who was Lupe's business manager, who then phoned his friend, the chief of police in Beverly Hills. And Weissmuller claims that Lupe met with Harold before her death, decorated her room in flowers, and dressed her in a negligee, and Weissmuller claims that Cooper was the father of the baby, and that he claimed that she took the Seconal pills to calm her nerves. Pregnant, 70 pills? I mean, she wouldn't have been able to stand up. And the police report said she was wearing, like, a silk pajama set. That's not really a negligee.
Not at all. I don't really understand all of the events that he goes on to describe, but we know that it's not past MGM to come in and stage any type of scene. We saw that with William Desmond Taylor. So I might be somewhat on board with them calling like the Beverly Hills chief to maybe get advice, but there's nothing to substantiate that her room was decorated in flowers. I dug deep, and that story is just, it's a little funky.
No, you know, and I think that that's where, I mean, a couple of things. First, the coroner was going to have an inquest, and then they said, oh, the suicide note, so the inquest, we'd call it a suicide. But I think that Johnny Weissmuller's story then gets kind of repurposed in Hollywood Babylon, which, you know, Kenneth Auger is known for repurposing some things. But, you know, it says in the book that Lupe was not discovered dead in her bed, but drowned in her bathroom toilet, which is crazy, and that she had staged a beautiful suicide by decorating her room with scented candles and flowers, and the Seconal did not mix well with her spicy Mexican Last Supper, and as a result, she became violently ill, stumbled to the bathroom to vomit, vomited on the floor, slipped on the tile, falling headfirst into the toilet where she drowned.
Yeah, well, I appreciate his salacious dramatics because, you know, we like the dramatics around here.
Yes.
Her cause of death in the police report, because it did go pull it, is Seconal poisoning, not drowning. So she didn't fall in the toilet bowl. And the coroner said that he had a dry patient on the table, not a wet patient. So that's not true. There was also no vomit spotted at the scene by any of the first responders.
And I think that Kinder would have said something, the secretary. You know, I think, you know, it's just a reach, and, you know, the book is filled with dramatics like that. But the thing is, the problem is that now everybody references the toilet death for Lupe. And I think that's kind of a tragedy.
It is, because that the way she died is starting to overshadow, you know, the legacy of her fantastic acting career, and even just you know, how colorful her personality was while she was living.
Yeah, you know, and Andy Warhol made a film, Lupe Velez, and Edie Sedgwick is in it and plays Lupe. Edie Sedgwick playing Lupe. Okay. And in the film, you know, I mean, it kind of, Edie is a Lupe kind of death, you know, if you think about it. So it kind of makes sense. It was kind of foreshadowing what was going to happen in Edie's world, too. I mean, and Edie got screwed over, too. You know, if you think about it, she got screwed over by Bob Dylan. And, you know, she was, you know, pregnant and said that the child was Bob Dylan's. But she had to get an abortion because Bob Dylan was already had just got married in a secret ceremony and stuff like that. So, and then, you know, so Edie got an abortion and then went to an insane asylum from drug abuse and stuff like that.
Yeah, she had a tragic life, too. And Bob Dylan's an interesting guy. You know, if you hear all, you read all the different things about him making a deal with the devil and all that, you know, it's fascinating.
It is. And I mean, there's the movie, I'm going to forget. Highway 61, I want to say. It's either 61 or 51. And which is a famous Bob Dylan song. It's Highway 61. And it's a movie, and it's the most bizarre movie, but I really highly recommend it. I haven't watched it in a long time, so maybe my opinion of it will change. I probably haven't watched it in a decade. And it's about the devil, you know, okay, so you got Bob Dylan, his song, and this devil just is driving down Highway 61, and it's weird, because the devil's just this normal guy, he's got the powers to do things, but he goes to, like, a bingo hall, and it just, he has the power, and he wins every single game of bingo, you know, and he moves down, and I forget all the, because it's been a long time since I've seen it, but from what I remember, it's a really good movie, and that kind of ties into the whole Bob Dylan making a deal with the devil, and then this movie. So, you know, Edie got screwed over, and, you know, just, but, I mean, and Edie had everything going for her, too, you know, and she did the same kind of thing. She, you know, you had Lupe with Harold, and then you had Edie, who ended up actually getting married, rather than just, you know, being with somebody, to this guy named Michael Post, this guy that she had met in rehab, and, you know, they got married in July of 1971, and then, you know, she was dead by November of 1971.
Yeah, she died from barbiturates and alcohol, too, and didn't she die laying next to him, and he was like, oh, I just thought she was sleeping, I never knew anything was wrong, and then he rolled over and realized she was dead? To me, that is so weird.
Yeah, and her dad, I mean, he was a problem. I mean, Edie's, I can't remember all of them. So one of Edie's siblings committed suicide. Another one got killed in a motorcycle accident. Then you had Edie, because there was eight kids. And I mean, it was a hugely, hugely wealthy family that lived in Santa Barbara. And they essentially, I mean, they had so much money and so much land. They gave away like 6,000 acres in Santa Barbara to University of California in Santa Barbara. I mean, I can't tell you how much money that's worth. And the school actually tried to sell it at some point, and everybody said, no, 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 you can't sell it. You can't sell it. You're not allowed to. That's kind of part of the deal. It was worth so much money. And, you know, and Edie died in 1971. And honestly, they just finally, because she was more famous, I think, after death than, you know, when she was alive. Because, I mean, there was a best-selling book. You had the Sienna Miller movie, and all of this kind of stuff. And so the husband wanted to get all the money, all these royalties or whatever. But it ended up going to, this guy who had made her last movie, and she had apparently given him the rights to anything. So he's the one who profits off her death. So it's a complicated thing, but it's kind of interesting that Edie was the one that played, you know, Lupe. It kind of is fitting in a way,
It is. You know? It was like art imitating life, imitating death. I mean, she ended up basically the same way that Lupe did.
And one of the things so Lupe lived on Rodeo Drive, not the Rodeo Drive where it's the same Rodeo Drive, but you have to, it's up closer to Sunset and in the flats, we call it. So Gary Cooper lived next door, and then across the street from Gary Cooper was Gene Kelly. So, I mean, this is quite the little block, you know, of people that lived there. And that's in the 700 block. And then in the 800 block was like Fred Astaire and Jackie Cooper and Barbara Stanwyck, Robert Taylor. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, just absolutely.
It is. When you look at old Hollywood, it's really interesting because while old Hollywood as a whole, yeah, all these people knew each other. But when you start looking at where they actually lived residential wise, they clump up. You can see the little circles of people that are really, really close to each other. You know, like Joan Crawford had her own little circle of people that she was real close to. And then you look at Lupe and Gary Cooper and them, they had their own little circle. It's just neat to kind of deep dive that.
If you ever come to L.A., I encourage anybody, and it's totally free. You can just Google it online. There is a Beverly Hills Former Homes of the Great Stars walking tour. They do include Jennifer Lopez in the list. But anyway, it's just a short walk. It's maybe like a mile and a half or something. There's two separate ones, that you can do. And it essentially takes you, because all of them were concentrated in one, you know, kind of area. You can see all these homes, and then you can also see, like where Howard Hughes had his crash. That's on the walking tour too. A Charlie Chaplin, like movie location, but it's a nice little walk. And you can see all these homes, and there's something almost every block. Some big names. So
yeah,
I
that's
just need...
fun. I mean, it's one thing to talk about them, right? But to actually walk in their shoes and see where these things kind of went down, you know, it's a completely different world. I highly recommend it.
It is. And, you know, I just need now to find out when Gary Cooper moved. And then I'll have, I mean, right now, I guess I'm leaning towards the fact that Gary is the father, but why did Lupe then just make it out to Harold? She's killing herself, right?
Well, yeah, she couldn't implicate Gary Cooper. I don't think she would do that. I think in the end, she loved him.
And so she
would. And that
would
have absolutely spelled like the end of his career if she had done that to him.
Yeah. Oh, one thing I want to say. So when we're talking about this walking tour kind of thing. So Gene Kelly lived for a time, like I said, across the street. But he also lived in this one house that's about a block and a half away. And in this one house. He lived there. Greta Garbo lived there. I mean, these are different times. Greta Garbo lived in that house. Frank Sinatra lived in that house. Ava Gardner lived in that house. Rex Harrison lived in that house. Barbara Streisand lived in that house. And Ringo Starr lived in that house.
Wow, the history.
Yeah. Oh, and Loretta Young. All of them lived at one time or another in 904 Bedford. I mean, that's just crazy. So, all right. Anyway, I could talk all day about Lupe. I think she's pretty amazing. Do you think it's Gary's?
Yeah, I do.
And she loved him to the death and didn't want him to. So then Harold becomes the bad guy for all eternity. But that's okay with her because he broke her heart?
Well, yeah, I think he's just the fall guy, the person that she selected. Maybe Gary Cooper said, hey, you know, just go find anyone that we can
and
put
they'll
into
marry
this.
You.
Yeah, anyone that'll marry you and anyone that we could put into this position. And they thought that he would be the weakest link. And in the end, he was like, no, I'm not going to go along with it, which was a huge stumbling block for them.
And I think part of the problem with that is, so she's 4 months pregnant, so she can't go out and find another like guy, another Rube, really, because the timing wouldn't match up and things like that. So she'd have to find somebody who'd be willing to be on board, knowing, you know, it's not their baby and stuff. And maybe she just thought that would be too difficult.
I'm wondering why she didn't go to the studio and approach
yeah,
them, a fixer,
exactly.
Perhaps, because fixers always got involved back then and asked them to fix the problem.
And I think that they would have, honestly.
I do, too. They could have found anyone to stick in that role and pay them a salary to go along with it. And, you know,
yeah,
always wonder why she didn't do that.
Or like the secretary said, she could easily go back to Mexico and just be there for 5 months and say, I'm making another movie in Mexico.
Yeah, like a lot of actresses did that, whether they put their babies up for adoption and went back and got them later, or they put them up for adoption for good. They would go off and have these things called extended vacations and have the baby and then come back and no one was, you know, none the wiser.
Well, Lupe, you know, you lived a really good life, the life that you lived. That's for sure. I think she enjoyed she lived every second of her life. 100%.
Yeah, she did. And she lived it her way and she went out her way. So, you know, in that respect, you know, good on her.
Yeah. You know, she was born in 1908. So, I mean, she would have been kind of older. A lot of these actresses that are from the 20s and the 30s, I've just noticed as I've been perusing like Love Boat episodes and they end up on Love Boat and I just feel so sorry for them. You know, that they were these huge screen stars and then they end up on some show like that. And I wouldn't have wanted that for Lupe. Well, we found another good one and I can't wait to see what we find next week.
Yeah, we'll find something to get into. Thanks for having me.
Of course. I hope everybody has a great weekend and I will talk to you later.
Yep. Stay safe. Bye.
Bye.